Have you ever seen venison or wild boar or quail in the grocery store and wondered, what am I supposed to do with that? Wild game, even the commercially raised game, is a tasty treat, but what to do can be confounding, especially for the price. How do you make that meat shine and be the star of the plate? The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 270, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Classical French cuisine can be intimidating. I've worked in food for many years, and that included working for two certified master chefs. Classical French was the bedrock of our experience. There are good cooking fundamentals to learn and use, and I'm going to use my experience as a culinary school teacher to share those fundamentals with you. The Escoffier series continues. We are in Chapter 9 now, Game. Hunting season is here. It was the case in my high school that the opening day of deer hunting season was an official day off of school. In my high school, just about half the students were gone for a day or two. Venison was the goal. It's a good goal. Very tasty. Generally, I think they came back mostly with memories. Escoffier starts the chapter with venison. He moves to wild boar, then hare and rabbit, then feathered game, pheasant, partridge, and quail. He discusses some smaller birds, thrush and woodcock, but those are rare and not found in the wild game section of the grocery store, which sells domesticated wild game, or at least farm-raised wild game. Oxymoronic, isn't it? One bird he doesn't mention that deserves to be mentioned is ostrich. Yeah, another farm bird, and it's exquisite. On to the deer. Wild venison is different from the farm-raised venison. Feed is the main difference, and so therefore the flavor of the meat and the color of the fat. Farm-raised venison will probably be fattier than the wild deer. Just like on beef and lamb, there are preferred cuts of meat. The backstrap, also called sometimes the saddle, is the long loin piece that is on the top of the deer. One loin piece of meat on each side of the vertebrae. Underneath and attached to the hip bone is the tenderloin. Now, and deer seem to be everywhere. They're in New Jersey and here, they're everywhere and just crossing every street. So probably you've seen one. And so the loin runs pretty much mostly from the hip to where the shoulder ends and the neck begins. And it gets, as it goes toward the neck, it gets thinner and it loses its appeal. It's nice parts near the butt. So if you sort of visualize the first 6 inches or so of that back, underneath the vertebrae, underneath the spinal column, is the tenderloin. It's not very big. It's a puny little thing. But it's a prized cut of meat, certainly for beef and for veal. It's much smaller on the deer and almost impossible to find on lamb. But anyway, those are the preferred cuts, two of them. The hind quarter, the big legs, because the legs do a lot of work, it's going to have, it's going to be very lean meat, but there will be some cuts that are really, really tough, and that's going to be good for grinding for venison burgers or cutting it up for braises or stews or soups or sausage or pâté. There's some pieces in there that are worth, and now the configuration of the leg on the deer, the lamb, the veal, the cow, it's all the same. It just gets smaller the smaller the animal is. So you're going to have your eye round in there. You're going to have all the pieces there. Just they're going to be smaller, and you might get good steak pieces out of there. The foreleg, the forequarter, it's same as on a cow, but cow's going to be bigger. For deer, I find that mostly to be stew meat. I just sort of just decide all of it's going to be tough meat. So it's either for sausage or for stew. It could go in for grind. It would be very good for grind for burgers. That's the chuck area. And I just don't really bother trying to find steaks out of there because it's just they're really small. Now, venison also has brisket, which is at the very front, and it's awfully, awfully puny. It's just, it's not even worth going to find. And it's not. I tried making venison pastrami not doing that again. So the prime cuts, the loin, the tenderloin, and some pieces of meat out of the leg. But we're going to talk mostly about the loin portion, the saddle, the backstrap. The first kitchen I worked in where I learned about game was at the Golden Mushroom, which was owned and chefed by Milos Cihalka, a certified master chef, and of interesting note, the first certified master chef. Milos always marinated his venison, no matter the final use, except if it was to be used for sausage or for pate. Now, there's an adage for compatibility that what grows together goes together. And so it is with venison. The irony is that juniper and lavender leaves are excellent accompanying flavors for venison, and venison don't eat them, at least not here. There's loads of lavender here and juniper everywhere and plenty of deer, and the plants are not diminished one bit, even in the middle of winter. For scoffier, tender pieces, mostly loin cuts, which we talked about, are the preferred cuts. Now, part of that reason is aesthetics, because they look pretty, they're nice and round, and part of that is practicality. The tender pieces will cook faster, which preserves the venison's flavor. Game meat, even farm-raised game meat, will develop unpleasant flavors when it's overcooked, and for game meat, overcooked steak and whole muscle meat is about medium. And it's not exactly the same for everybody because flavor is different for most people, but it tends to, at least to me, that unpleasantness starts to taste livery. And most people really, really hate liver. Turns out I like liver, but I also don't like tough meat. And because game meat is so lean, so virtually no intramuscular fat, no intramuscular fat, when it gets overcooked, it's also going to get tough, and then that's no fun either. Now, as with lamb, venison gets two words for pretty much the same portion. A cutlet and a noisette are fundamentally the same cut of meat. I think, and there's no codification to this. There's no absolute law. I've seen noisettes cut 2 inches thick. Well, that's absurd. That's a freaking steak. That's not a noisette. The scoffier identifies the best end, which is the part that starts at the hip bone and moves forward toward the front of the deer. And that best end is going to end at about the 6th rib. And then the loin starts to flatten out after that. It's still a fine piece of meat, but it can no longer be called the best end. It's maybe the mediocre middle. I made that up. I'm kidding. So it's the thicker end. It's going to be rounder. It's going to be a bigger piece. And so you get a nicer cut out of that. I think, at least as far as how I would cut them, a cutlet would be a thinner slice than a noisette. A noisette might be 5/8 to 3/4 of an inch thick. A cutlet would be 1/4 to 1/2 inch thick. And to ensure tenderness and fast cooking, I might even take that cutlet and with a meat mallet, pound it a couple of times just to sort of break up that muscle fiber so that it's going to be a little bit more tender. Now, that does come with an unintended consequence, which we can know about. And that unintended consequence is going to be you're going to get more water out of the meat because we've broken some of those cell walls. We've disturbed the meat in its condition. So we're going to have to, something will happen, and the happening will be more water comes out. We're going to cover that here in just a second. The chief goal in either case of cutting the meat is quick cooking. The chief goal for sautéing game meats, particularly our cutlets and our noisette, is to cook them in a very hot pan with clarified butter and only up to mid-rare, maybe even less than that, because we're going to have some carryover cooking. Now, I've talked before, hot pan, medium hot pan, very hot pan. This is very specific, and as Scott Fier says, very hot pan. Well, how hot is that? Clarified butter is going to get a smoke point of somewhere in the neighborhood of 420 degrees or so. Duck fat burns pretty hot. Goose fat burns pretty hot. So you can get a hot, hot pan, which we want to have happen. With your piece of venison, salt and pepper it. Don't flour it, because flour is going to burn. And in the pan, nice and hot. When you spread your fingers wide, and from your tip of your pinky to the tip of your thumb, and most people is roughly about 9 inches. If you have a saute pan that's about that big, and you try to put 15 pieces of venison in there, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. So we talk about having a hot pan, and one of the things that happens to hot pans when you put relatively cold things in them is the heat goes away. So in that hot pan, let's say it's, I don't know what the numbers are going to be. So we have 420 degrees. We put in 4 pieces of venison. Well, the heat's still on the pan. So we can tell by listening listening with our nose. We can tell by the sound the meat makes in the pan what's happening to the temperature. If you put one in, it goes psst, really high, tight, crisp sound. And the next one, and the next one, and the next one, you sort of still hear it psst, 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 psst. It's almost all the same. Then you're keeping the heat in the pan. If you put 5 or 6 or 7 in there and it goes, the pitch goes lower, and I'm not good at that, that means you're losing heat. And instead of searing the meat, it's just sort of stewing the meat. The water is going to come out faster than the Maillard reaction can caramelize the amino acids. That's what we want to have happen. We want the high heat to caramelize the amino acids faster than the cell walls break and release the water. Because when they release the water, they turn caramel, they dilute the caramel. So all of our efforts in getting the color on the meat is going to be gone because the water is coming out too fast. Now, we're not going to have a nice, good sear on the outside, and sear is flavor. We like that caramel flavor. The flavor part's not completely lost because it's still stuck on the bottom of the pan, but we're losing water from the meat into the pan, and our sauce isn't going to replace it in the meat. So a very hot pan, maintain a very hot pan by not overcrowding the pan. And the same thing happens when you make a stew. So we have a very hot pan, clarified butter, duck fat, goose fat. Cook not more than medium rare. And how do you know how soft it is? Well, I can't say that in a podcast, but you're better off undercooking than overcooking on your thin pieces of meat there. Now, in the classical kitchen, long before the meat hit the pan, the saucier would have made stock from the bones and then sauces from the stock, and the cook would have that sauce on his station to finish each dish. That task is much more difficult at home. Beef stock will work. Roasted chicken stock or lamb stock will work. The point of the sauce is at least twofold. The first task of the sauce is to deglaze the pan, and then the final additions, whatever those garnishes are going to be. Then in nearly every case, the sauce will be finished with a small pat of butter swirled into the sauce at the end, and the swirling, the heat of the sauce and the swirling of the sauce do two things. The heat melts it, and the swirling emulsifies the whole butter into the sauce, which gives it a higher shine value, because now it's got melted fat, and it improves the flavor. Of course it does. It's butter. Then, your finished sauce, you drape that over the plated meat. Now, here's one more twist. Escoffier is fond of putting beef tournedos on croutons of brioche. That toasted bread gives some height to the dish. The crouton also keeps the meat from sitting in its own juices, and the crouton absorbs the juices from the meat and also absorbs the sauce for some amazing bites. You are not required to take those extra steps, but they do add an impressive presentation and eating experience. Game meat, venison, and wild boar, and even that ostrich, even though it's a bird, the meat eats like steak. Really. They can tolerate some bold, powerful flavors. If stock isn't something you have, or isn't something you wish to make, and for this, I would very much avoid that boxed stuff in the grocery store, deglaze the pan with some brandy. If you have a gas burner stovetop, turn the burner off for a moment. Brandy in a hot pan makes fat particles fly, and the alcohol around an open flame will do predictable and hot things. It will flame up. If your face is too near the pan, that will not be a happy memory. Then turn the pan back on. Add some green peppercorns or whole grain mustard to the pan. You could add small cut up cornichons or, I guess you can sort of go wild with whatever appeals to you. So add your stuff and then add some heavy cream. Scrape the bits off the pan into the sauce and let that reduce. Check the seasoning and drape that sauce on the meat. Cream sauce does not need a pat of butter at the end. You're welcome to do it, but it isn't necessary. I mentioned earlier that venison might be marinated. The marinade is an excellent source of flavor for deglazing the pan. Use that before you add the stock, and also work the sticky bits off the pan into the sauce. Now, the restaurant kitchen is going to strain, even to order, well, I guess it depends on the place, might strain that sauce to go once they scrape those bits off. In that case, the garnishes, the whole grain mustard, the green peppercorns, the cut up cornichons, those garnish pieces are going to be added after the sauce is strained. And then those pieces are going to be, what they're looking to avoid is the little pieces that didn't dissolve into the sauce from the bottom of the pan or strained out. I'm not going to serve that to the guest, but we're going to give them the flavor. You can also use the marinade if you're making a cream sauce. The color will be interesting, but the flavor will make up for any of the curious colorings you get. Stewing is stewing, except for flavor profiles. What that means is it doesn't matter if it's lamb, venison, beef, veal, ostrich, don't stew. Well, yeah, mostly it was all tender, which was kind of amazing. I once made, and I didn't write it down as far as I can tell, and I have been looking off and on for years, I made the most amazing venison stew. I am certain I borrowed the idea from Paul Bocuse, and that was a venison stew with prunes, lavender, and unsweetened chocolate. OMFG. It was amazing. I've come close to repeating it a few times, but never as good as that first one. If you find venison in the grocery store or in an online catalog, there's a better than fair chance you can't get the chuck or the rump or even the hindquarter. Maybe a piece of steak out of it. Maybe you can get shanks for ossobuco, and probably you can get the loin and maybe the tenderloin. If you live near a proper butcher, maybe they can help you. If you know a friend who happened to hit a deer and calls you and asks if you want it, maybe you do. Roadkill in the wintertime, yes, I know, roadkill. Roadkill in the wintertime is at least refrigerated. In the course of my time on the planet, I've gotten one deer that way and some quail. Well, not roadkill quail, exactly. A friend's dog scared them up and they flew in a window. And each one broke its neck. So, as an aside, don't be fooled by the plumage on a bird. A bird is half the size after you get the feathers off. Now, around here, quail are everywhere. They're like, they're worse than chickens. They're just yard birds all over. They run down the street. They're everywhere. And there's flocks of them by the dozens. And they look, and you look at them, wow, look at how big that bird is. Nope. Ain't big. Scafe recommends either barding or larding your venison. Barding is wrapping the meat with thin slices of pork fatback. Larding is using a special larding needle to pierce the meat and sew a piece of fat. Well, let's say 3/16 of an inch by 3/16 of an inch by 3 or 4 inches long. And you use that needle to sew. You go in, sew the fat in, and come out. So you sew these little pieces of meat, fat, into the muscle. Now, I'm not sold on the effectiveness of these procedures. I've done them both, and the most barding has to redeem it is that it prevents the flesh from the pheasant from getting tough and stringy. Larding looks interesting, but I've never noticed the meat much improved for the fat being there. I'll leave rabbit for the next episode. Hare isn't something I've seen in the store. I've seen them in the mountain behind my house. They're big and fast, and they have huge ears and giant feet. When sautéing cutlets or noisettes, first cut them smaller than larger. Cook them in a very hot pan and not more than to medium rare. Make a crouton, not exactly the same as you buy for salads, but make a crouton for meat. Cut the crusts off a piece of bread, and what remains is cooked slowly on the stovetop in clarified butter until it is crisp and golden brown on both sides. That's a proper crouton for meat. Now, Scafier is going to have cut this one into a diamond shape, cut this one into a trapezoid, cut this one into a rhombus, cut that one into a heart, whatever. I mean, yeah, okay. But at home, just cut them as you cut them and save the trim for breadcrumbs for something else. Make your own chicken fingers. But whatever you don't use, just make breadcrumbs out of it and save it for some other use. So you've got your crouton, you put your meat on top of your crouton, sauce it up, deglaze the pan. Game meat is rich. So a nice pickled eggplant, or something a touch acidic is a good contrast. And generally game's also going to be served with lingonberries or disgustingly, red currant jelly is almost as bad as mint jelly. Or preserved red currants. Red currants are popular because they think the deer eat them, and they might. I don't know. So anyway, sweet. jams and jellies. It's kind of right out of the mid 70s, and it's really kind of, it's a good thing, in my opinion. Personally, it's a good thing that whatever that thing was, that tradition, that habit, it's a good thing that ended. Croutons is a good idea. That's remains a good idea because you get really good flavor, and that's a helpful thing. And pretty garnishes are good. Same thing that contributes to flavor. The sweet berries is yuck. So you're invited to not do that. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I hope you are pacing yourself for desserts in just a few more weeks. We made a pecan pie this year. My daughter wanted it, and so why not? Pecan pie in 4,500 feet isn't exactly the same thing as pecan pie at 0 feet. The goo ran out and all over the edges. Now, of course, we put a sheet pan under it, which is why we do that. We figured out that even at this sort of mediocre height, a lower temperature oven is probably what will save us next time. So 350 at this high, probably no good for that kind of a pie. So we'll find out, and I'll tell you in 4 weeks. So that's the tease that Christmas will be the next. She's decided that she wants to make another one, so we'll do that. And also another, I'm sure, chocolate soaked pie, because they're freaking good. For the cook in your family, buy Cooking for Comfort from Amazon. That's my cookbook, which is designed to keep mess to a minimum and flavor to a maximum. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.